Promise me something. Keep the others safe. Get them to Roswell. A faint but discernible nod against his chest.
What about you?
How he loved her. And yet the words themselves could never be spoken. Holding her in his arms, he closed his eyes and tried to inscribe the feeling of her into his mind, into memory, so that he could take this with him. I think you've looked after me long enough. Don't you? He pulled away to see her face a final time. That's all, he said. I just wanted to thank you. And then he turned and walked away, leaving her standing alone in the icy wind outside the silent barracks. He did his best to sleep, turning restlessly through the night, and in the last hour before dawn, when he could wait no more, rose and quickly packed his gear. It was the cold he was thinking of. They would need blankets, extra socks, anything that could keep them warm and dry. Sleeping sacks and ponchos and a tarp with a good sturdy rope. The night before, on his way back from the barracks, he had ducked into the supply tent and pilfered an entrenching tool and a hand axe and a pair of heavy parkas. Hollis was softly snoring on his cot, a bearded face buried in blankets, oblivious. When he awoke, Peter would be gone. He hoisted the pack to his shoulder and stepped outside, into a cold so sharp it stunned him, sucking the air from his lungs. The garrison was quiet, just a few men moving about. The smells of wood smoke and warm food reached him from the mess, making his stomach rumble. But there was no time for that. In the women's tent he found Amy sitting on her bunk, her small pack resting on her lap. He'd told her nothing. She was alone. Sarah was still with Sancho and the others in the infirmary. "Is it time?" she asked him. Her eyes were very bright. "Yes. It's time." They crossed together to the paddock. Greer's horse, a large black gelding, his coat heavy for winter, was grazing with the others, noses angled to the wind. Peter retrieved a bridle from the shed and led him to the fence. He wished he could use a saddle, but it wouldn't work with two. He lashed their packs together, draping them over the animal's withers. His fingers were already stiff with the cold. He lifted Amy up, then used the fence to climb aboard. They rode around the edge of the paddock to the shadows under the pickets, headed for the gate. Dawn was just breaking, a gray softening, as if the darkness were not lifting but dissolving. A pale, almost invisible snow had begun to fall, flakes that seemed to materialize in the air before their faces. They were met at the gate by a single sentry. Eustace, the lieutenant who had first alerted Peter to the raiding party's return.
"Major says to let you pass.
He also asked me to give you this." Eustace dragged a duffel bag from the sentry hut and lay it on the ground before the horse.
"Says to take whatever you need."
Peter swung down and knelt to open it. Rifles, magazines, a couple of pistols, a belt of grenades. Peter looked through all of it, thinking about what to do. "Thanks anyway," he said, drawing upright. He drew his blade from his belt and held it out for Eustace to take.
"Here.
A present for the Major." Eustace frowned.
"I don't get it. You want to give me your blade?"
Peter pushed it toward him. "Take it," he said. Reluctantly, Eustace accepted the blade. For a moment he just looked at it, as if it were some strange artifact he'd found in the forest. "Give it to Major Greer," Peter said. "I think he'll understand." He turned to address Amy, sitting high above him. She had tipped her chin upward to the falling snow. "Ready?" The girl nodded. A faint smile shone on her face. Flakes had caught on her lashes, in her hair, like jeweled dust. Eustace gave Peter a leg up. He swung onto the horse's back, taking the reins in his hand. The gate drew open before them. He allowed himself one last look toward the barracks, but all was quiet, unchanged. Goodbye, he thought. Goodbye. Then he heeled his mount, and they rode out into the breaking day. Part 10. The Angel of the Mountain. Like to a hermit poor in place obscure, I mean to spend my days of endless doubt, to wail such woes as time cannot recure, when none but love shall ever find me out. Sir Walter Raleigh, from The Phoenix Nest. Chapter 62. By half-day they had found the river again. They rode in silence under the snow, which was falling steadily now, filling the woods with a muffling light. The river had begun to freeze at its edges, dark water flowing freely in its narrowed channel, oblivious. Amy, leaning against Peter's back, her pale wrists slack in his lap, had fallen asleep. He felt the warmth of her body, the slow rise and fall of her chest against him. Plumes of warm vapor flowed back from the horse's nostrils, smelling of grass and earth. There were birds in the trees, blackbirds. They called to one another from the branches, their voices dimmed by the smothering snow. As he rode, memories came to him, a disordered assemblage of images that drifted across his consciousness like smoke. His mother, on a day not long before the end, as he stood in the door to her room to watch her sleep, and saw her glasses sitting on the table, and knew that she would die. Theo at the station, when he'd sat on the cot to take Peter's foot in his hand, and again, standing on the porch of the farmstead, Mausami at his side, watching them leave. Auntie in her overheated kitchen, and the taste of her terrible tea. The last night at the bunker, everyone drinking whiskey and laughing at something funny Caleb had done or said, the great unknown unfolding before them. Sarah, on the morning after the first snowfall, sitting against the log, her book in her lap, her face bathed in sunlight and her voice saying, "How beautiful it is here." Alicia. Alicia. They turned east. They were in a new place now, the landscape rising ruggedly around them, wrapping them in the forested embrace of the mountains, mantled in white. The snow eased, then stopped, then started up once more. They had begun to climb. Peter's attention had narrowed to the smallest things. The slow rhythmic progress of the horse, the feel of worn leather in his fist where he held the animal's reins, the gentle brush of Amy's hair on his neck. All somehow inevitable, like details from a dream he'd had once years ago. When darkness came on, Peter used the shovel to clear a spot and pitched their tarp at the edge of the river. Most of the wood on the ground was too wet to burn, but beneath the heavy canopy of trees, they found enough dry kindling to get a fire going. Peter had no blade, but in his pack was a small pocket knife that he could use to open the cans. They ate their dinner and slept, huddled together for warmth. They awoke to bone-numbing cold. The storm had passed, leaving in its wake a sky of fierce, cold blueness. While Amy built a fire, Peter went to look for the horse, which had broken loose and wandered away in the night, a situation that under different circumstances would have brought him to outright panic, and yet somehow on this morning did not alarm him. He tracked the animal 100 meters downstream, where he found him nibbling on some grassy shoots at the river's edge, his great black muzzle bearded with snow. It did not seem like the kind of thing Peter ought to disturb, so he stood a while, watching the horse eat its breakfast, before leading him back to camp, where Amy's efforts had produced a small, smoky fire of damp needles and crackling twigs. They ate from more cans and drank cold water from the river, then warmed themselves together by the fire, taking their time. It would be their last morning, he knew. To the west, behind them, the garrison would be empty and silent now, all the soldiers moving south. "I think this is it," he told Amy as he was tying the bags onto the horse. "I don't think we have more than 10 kilometers to go." The girl said nothing, merely nodded. Peter led the horse to a fallen log, a great sodden thing at least a meter high, and used this to step up. He got himself situated, pulling the packs tight against him, and reached out to pull her aboard.
"Do you miss them?" Amy asked. "Your friends?"
He lifted his face toward the snowy trees. The morning air was calm and sunlit.
"Yes, but it's all right."
They came some time later to a fork. For a period of some hours they had been following a road, or what had once been a road. Beneath the snow, the ground was firm and even, the route marked here and there by a rusted sign or a weather-beaten guardrail. They were moving deeper into a narrowing valley, walled cliffs rising on either side, showing their rocky faces. That was when they came to the place where the road split in two directions. Straight, along the river, or across it on a bridge, an arched span of exposed girders covered with snow. On the opposite side, the roadway rose again and angled into the trees, away. "Which direction?" he asked her. A silent moment passed.
"Across," she said.
They dismounted. The snow was deep, a loose powder that rose nearly to the tops of Peter's boots. As they approached the riverbank, Peter saw that the connecting roadway was gone. The bridge's decking, which had probably once been wood, was all rotted away. 50 meters. They could probably manage it, balancing on the exposed beams, but the horse would never make it.
"You're sure?"
She was standing beside him, squinting intently in the light. Her hands, like his own, were drawn up protectively into the sleeves of her coat. She nodded. He returned to the horse to unhitch their packs. There was no question of leaving Greer's horse tied up to wait for them. It had brought them this far. Peter couldn't leave it defenseless. He finished unloading their gear, unhitched the bridle, and stepped to the animal's hindquarters. "Ha!" he yelled, giving the animal a firm slap on its haunches. Nothing. He tried again, louder this time.
"Ha!"
He slapped and yelled and waved his arms.
"Go on! Get!"
Still the animal refused to budge, gazing at them impassively with his huge, gleaming eyes.
"He's a stubborn son of a bitch. I guess he doesn't want to leave."
"Just tell him what you want him to do." "He's a horse, Amy." And yet what happened next, strange as it was, did not feel wholly unexpected. Amy took the animal's face in her hands, placing her palms against the side of his long head. The horse, which had begun to fidget, quieted under her touch. His wide nostrils flared with a heavy sigh. For a long, hushed moment, girl and horse stood there, locked in some deep and mutual regard. Then the animal broke away, turned in a wide circle, and began to walk in the direction they had come. His pace quickened to a trot as he vanished in the trees. Amy lifted her pack off the snow and hoisted it to her shoulders.
"We can go now."
Peter didn't know what to say. There was no reason to say anything. They clambered down the embankment to the river's edge. The reflected sunlight dancing on the surface of the water was almost explosively brilliant, as if on the edge of freezing solid its reflective powers had been magnified. Peter sent Amy up first, giving her a knee to send her through a hatch-like opening in the exposed beams. Once she was situated, he passed her the packs, then chinned himself up. The safest route would be along the edge of the bridge, where they could hold on to the guardrail as they stepped from beam to beam. The feel of the cold metal on his hands was like fire, an exquisite sharpness. They couldn't get this done fast enough. Amy went first, skipping with confident grace over the gaps. As he made to follow her, it became instantly clear that the problem wasn't the beams themselves, which seemed solid, but what encased them under the snow. A hidden skin of ice. Twice Peter felt himself losing traction, his feet slipping out from under him, his hand biting into the frigid rail, barely holding on. But to come this far, only to drown in an icy river. He couldn't imagine it. Slowly, beam by beam, he made his way across. By the time he reached the far side, Peter's hands felt utterly numb. He had begun to shiver. He wished they could stop to build a fire, but there was no delaying their progress now. Already the shadows had begun to lengthen. The brief winter day would soon be over. They ascended the bank of the river and began to climb. Wherever they were going, he hoped there would be shelter. He didn't see how they would last the night without it. Never mind the virals. Cold like this could kill them just as easily. The important thing was to keep moving. Amy had taken the lead, her strides carrying her up the mountain. It was all Peter could do to keep up. The air felt thin in his lungs. Around him the trees were moaning in the wind. After a period of time had passed, he looked back and beheld the valley far below them, the river curling through it. They were in shadow now, a zone of twilight, but on the far side of the valley, the faces of the mountains, receding to the north and east, thrummed with golden light. The top of the world, Peter thought. That's where Amy is taking me. The very top of the world. The day drained away. In the descending gloom, the landscape appeared as a confusing jumble. What Peter had thought would be the apex of their climb revealed itself to be a crest in a series of ascents, each more exposed and wind-blasted than the last. To the west, the mountain fell away sharply, an almost sheer drop. The cold seemed to have reached some deeper place inside him, dulling his senses. It had been a mistake, he realized, to send the horse away. If push came to shove, they could at least have hiked back down and used his body for warmth and shelter. It was a grave thing to kill such an animal, nothing he could have imagined doing before. But now, as darkness was falling on the mountain, he knew he could have done it. He realized Amy had come to a stop. He struggled forward and halted at her side, breathing great gulps of air. The snow was thinner here, pushed away by the wind. She was scanning the sky, her eyes narrowed as if she were listening to some distant sound. Beads of ice clung to her pack, her hair. What is it? Her gaze settled on the line of trees to their left, away from the open valley.
There,
she said. But there was nothing, only the wall of trees. The trees, and the snow, and the indifferent wind. Then he saw it. A gap in the undergrowth. Amy was already moving toward it. As they neared, he realized what he was seeing. The gate of a half-fallen fence. It ran the length of the woods on either side of them, entwined with a dense mass of camouflaging vines, now denuded of leaves and covered in snow, making the fence all but invisible, a part of the landscape. Who knew how long they had been walking along it without his noticing? Beyond the opening stood a small hut, more suggestion than actual structure. The building, not more than 5 meters square, seemed tipped, one part of its foundation having collapsed beneath it. The door stood half open, angled on its hinges. He peered inside. Nothing. Only snow and leaves, rivers of rot running down the walls. He turned. Amy, where... He saw her darting through the trees, away, and lumbered after her. Amy was moving more quickly now, practically running. Through the fog of his exhaustion and the trudge of his frozen feet, Peter had become aware that they had reached the end of their journey, or nearly. Something was leaving him. His strength, stripped away by the cold, was leaving him at last. "Amy!" he called. "Stop!" She seemed not to hear him.
"Amy! Please!"
She turned to face him.
"What's here?" he pleaded. "There's nothing here!"
"There is, Peter."
Her face was lit with joy.
"There is."
"Then where is it?"
he said, and heard the anger in his voice. His hands were on his knees. He was panting for breath.
"Tell me where it is."
She lifted her face to the darkening sky, letting her eyes fall shut.
"It's everywhere,"
she said.
"Listen."
He did his best. With every ounce of his remaining strength, he sent his mind outward. But all he heard was the wind.
"There's nothing,"
he said again, and felt his hopes collapsing.
"Amy, there's nothing here."
But then he heard it. A voice. A human voice. Somebody, somewhere, was singing. They saw the beacon first, rising in the trees. They had come into a clearing, the forest parting. All around them, Peter could discern evidence of human habitation, the suggestive shapes of ruined buildings and abandoned vehicles under the snow. The antenna stood at the edge of a wide depression in the earth, full of debris. A foundation of some kind, for a building long since gone. The antenna was positioned to the side of it, a four-legged metal tower rising high above them, anchored in place by steel cables sunk in concrete. Affixed to its apex was a gray orb studded with spikes. Beneath the orb, encircling the tower and jutting from the sides like the petals of a flower, was a series of paddle-like objects. Perhaps these were solar panels. Peter didn't know. He placed a hand on the cold metal. Something appeared to be written on one of the struts. He brushed the snow aside, revealing the words, United States Army Corps of Engineers.
Amy.
But the place beside him was empty. He detected movement at the edge of the clearing and quickly followed her into the underbrush. The sound of singing was stronger now. Not words, but a wash of notes in phrased patterns rising and falling. It seemed to be drifting toward them from all directions on the wind. They were close now, very close. He sensed the presence of something up ahead, an openness. The trees separating, the sky exposed. He reached the place where Amy stood, and then stopped. It was a woman. She was facing away, standing in the dooryard of a small log house. The windows of the house were lighted, and curls of smoke coiled from the chimney. She was shaking out a blanket. More blankets sagged on a line that stretched between a pair of trees. The incredible thought reached him that this woman, whoever she was taking in her laundry. Taking in her laundry and singing. The woman was wearing a heavy woolen cloak. Her hair, dense and dark with streaks of snowy white, flowed over her shoulders in a cloud-like mass. The lines of her bare legs descended from the edge of the cloak to her feet, on which she appeared to be wearing nothing more than a pair of rope sandals, her toes in the snow. Peter and Amy moved toward her, the words of her song resolving as they approached. Her voice had a rich, full-throated sound to it, full of a mysterious contentment. She sang and went about her work, placing the blankets in a basket at her feet, apparently oblivious to their presence. The two of them were standing just a few meters behind her now.
"Sleep, my child, and peace attend thee," the woman sang. "All through the night, guardian angels God will send thee, all through the night. Soft the drowsy hours are creeping, hill and dale in slumber sleeping. I, my loved one's watch, am keeping, all through the night."
She halted, her hands poised over the line.
"Amy."
The woman turned. She had a broad, handsome face and dark skin, like Auntie's. But it was not an old woman he saw. Her skin was firm, her eyes clear and bright. Her face bloomed with a radiant smile.
"Oh, it is good to see you."
Her voice was like music, as if she were singing the words. She advanced toward them on her sandaled feet and took Amy by the hands, holding them with a maternal tenderness.
"My little Amy, all grown up."
She let her eyes drift past Amy toward Peter, appearing to notice him for the first time.
"And here he is, your Peter."
She gave her head a little shake of wonder.
"Just as I knew he would be. Do you remember, Amy, when I said to you, 'Who is Peter?' It was when I first met you. You were very small."
Tears had begun to fall from Amy's eyes.
"I left him." "Hush now. It is as it had to be." "He told me to run," she cried out. "I left him. I left him."
The woman jostled Amy's hands.
And you will find him again, Amy. That's what you have come to find out, isn't it? I was not the only one to watch over you through all the years and years. That sadness you feel is not your own. It's his sadness you feel in your heart, Amy, for missing you.
The sun was down. Cold darkness crowded around them, standing in the snow outside the woman's house. And yet Peter could make himself neither move nor speak. That he was a part of what had just unfolded he did not doubt, and yet he did not know what part. He found his voice at last.
"Tell me," he said. "Please. Tell me who you are."
The woman's eyes sparkled with sudden mischief.
"Shall we tell him, Amy? Shall we tell your Peter who I am?"
Amy nodded. The woman raised her face, wearing a shining smile.
"I am the one who's been waiting for you," she said. "My name is Sister Lacey Antoinette Cudotto."
Chapter 63. Private Sancho was dying. Sarah was riding at the back of the convoy in one of the big trucks. Bunks had been slung from the sides of the rear compartment to carry the injured men. The space was crowded with crates of supplies. It was all Sarah could do to wedge herself between them, to offer what comfort she could. The other one, Withers, wasn't as bad off. Most of the burns were on his arms and hands. Probably he would survive if sepsis didn't set in. But not Sancho. Something had happened when they'd winched down the bomb. A cable had jammed, the fuse wouldn't light, something. The story had come to Sarah in bits and pieces from a dozen different sources, all with a slightly different version of events. It was Sancho who had entered the mine shaft, shimmying down the cable on a harness to fix whatever had gone wrong. He had either still been down the hole or was just emerging, Withers running toward him, reaching for him, pulling him free, when the drums of fuel exploded. The flames had engulfed him utterly. She could see the path the fire had taken, moving up his body, fusing his uniform to his flesh. That he had survived was a miracle, though not, Sarah thought, a happy one. She could still hear the screams that had torn from his lips as, with the help of two soldiers, she had peeled the blackened remains of his uniform from his body, taking most of the skin of his legs and chest with it, and again as she had done her best to scrub away the debris, revealing a raw, red flesh beneath it. Already the burns on his legs and feet had begun to suppurate, mixing the sick, sweet odor of charred skin with the stink of infection. His chest and arms and hands and shoulders, the fire had consumed them all. His face was a smooth pink nub like the eraser on a pencil. After she'd finished the abrasion, a horrible ordeal, he'd made scarcely any sound at all, lapsing into a fitful sleep from which he awoke only to beg for water. She was surprised when, in the morning, he was still alive, and then the next day also. The night before their departure, she had offered, in a moment of bravery that surprised her, to stay behind with him. But Greer would have none of it. "We've left enough men in these woods," he said. "Do your best to make him comfortable." For a while the convoy had traveled east, but now they were moving south again, on what felt to Sarah like a road. The worst of the bouncing, the lurching from side to side, and the sound of spinning mud and snow spattering against the wheel wells beneath her had stopped. She felt nauseated and cold, chilled to the core, her limbs achy from the hours of banging in the back of the truck. The convoy of vehicles and horses and men proceeded in fits and starts, as Alicia's scouting party gave the all-clear. The goal for their first day of travel was Durango, where a fortified shelter in an old grain elevator, one of nine such refuges along the supply road to Roswell, offered safety for the night. She had decided she wasn't angry that Peter had left without telling her. She had been at first, when Hollis came to the mess to give her the news. But with Sancho and Withers to take care of, she hadn't dwelt on these feelings for long. And the truth was, she'd sensed it coming. If not Peter's and Amy's departure exactly, then something like it. Something final. When she and Hollis had discussed leaving with the convoy, always in the background, unstated, was the feeling that Peter and Amy wouldn't be going with them. But Michael had been angry. More than angry, furious. Hollis had practically had to restrain him from heading off after the two of them into the snow. Strange how Michael had become so brave, almost recklessly so, over the months. She had always felt herself to be a kind of stand-in parent, responsible for him in some deep, incontrovertible way. Somewhere along the way, she had let these feelings go. So maybe it wasn't Michael who had changed. Perhaps it was she herself. She wanted to see Kerrville. The name hung in her mind with a shimmering weightlessness. To think, 30,000 souls. It gave her a hope she hadn't felt since the day Teacher had taken her out the door of the sanctuary into the broken world. Because it wasn't broken after all. The little girl Sarah had been, the one who slept in the big room and played with her friends and felt the sun on her face as she swung on the tire in the courtyard, believing the world to be a fine place that she could be a part of. That little girl had been right all along. Such a simple thing to want. To be a person. To live a human life. That was what she would have in Kerrville. With Hollis. Hollis, who loved her, and told her so again and again. It was as if he'd opened something up inside her, something long clenched. For the feeling had filled her at once that first night on watch, somewhere in Utah, when he'd put his rifle down and kissed her. And again each time he said the words in his quiet, almost embarrassed way, their faces so close she could feel the tangles of his beard on her cheeks, as if he were confessing the deepest truth of himself. He told her he loved her, and she loved him in return, at once and infinitely. She did not believe in fate. The world seemed far chancier than that, a series of mishaps and narrow escapes you somehow managed to survive until one day you didn't. Yet that's what loving Hollis felt like fate. As if the words were already written down someplace, and all she had to do was live out the story. She wondered if her parents had felt that way about each other. Though she did not like to think about them and avoided this whenever she could, she found herself, riding in the back of the cold truck, wishing they were still alive, so she could ask this question. It wasn't fair, what they had done. It was Michael. Poor Michael, who had found the two of them in the shed that terrible morning. He was 11. Sarah had just turned 15. Part of her believed that their parents waited until she was old enough to look after her brother, that her age was part of the rationale for what they'd done. By the time Michael's yells had pulled her out of bed and down the stairs and across the yard to the shed behind their house, he had flung his arms around their legs, trying to hold them up. She'd stood in the door, speechless and immobile, Michael crying and begging her to help him, and known that they were dead. What she had felt at that moment was not horror or grief, but something like wonder, a mute amazement at the factually declarative nature of the scene, its merciless mechanics. They had used ropes and a pair of wooden stools. They had tied the ropes around their necks, slipping the knots tight, and kicked the stools aside, employing the weight of their bodies to strangle themselves. She wondered, did they do it together? Had they counted to three? Did first one go and then the other? Michael was pleading, "Please, Sarah, help me save them." And yet that was all she saw. The night before, her mother had made Johnny cake. The pan was still sitting on the kitchen table. Sarah had searched her mind for some evidence that her mother had gone about this task in any way that seemed different, knowing, as she must have, that she was preparing a breakfast she would not eat, for children she would never see again. And yet Sarah could remember nothing. As if obeying some final tacit command, she and Michael had eaten it all, every bite. And by the time they were done, Sarah knew, as Michael surely did as well, that she would take care of her brother from that day forward, and that part of this care was the unspoken agreement that they would never speak of their parents again. The convoy had slowed. Sarah heard a shout from up ahead, calling them to halt, and then the sound of a single horse galloping past them through the snow. She climbed to her feet and saw that Withers's eyes were open and looking about. His bandaged arms lay over his chest on top of the blankets. His face was flushed, damp with sweat.
"Are we there?"
Sarah felt his forehead with the base of her wrist. He didn't seem to have a fever. If anything, his skin was too cold. She retrieved a canteen from the floor and dribbled a bit into his waiting mouth. No fever, and yet he looked much worse. He couldn't seem to lift his head at all.
"I don't think so. This itching is driving me crazy. Like my arms are crawling with ants."
Sarah capped the canteen and put it aside. Fever or no fever, his color had her worried.
"That's a good sign. It means you're healing under there."
"It doesn't feel like it."
Withers took a long breath and let the air out slowly.
"Fuck."
Sancho was in the berth beneath him, swaddled in bandages. Only the small pink circle of his face was showing. Sarah knelt and took a stethoscope from her medkit to listen to his chest. She heard a wet rattle, like water sloshing in a can. It was dehydration, as much as anything, that was killing him. And yet he was drowning in his own lungs. His cheeks were blazing to the touch. The air around him was sharp with the smell of infection. She tucked the blanket around him and moistened a rag and held it to his lips.
"How's he doing?"
Withers asked from above. Sarah rose.
"He's close, isn't he? I can see it in your face."
She nodded.
"I don't think it will be long now."
Withers closed his eyes once more. She pulled on her parka and climbed from the back of the truck into the snow and sunlight. The orderly lines of soldiers had dissolved into clusters of three or four men, standing around with scowls of bored impatience on their faces, hoods drawn up over their heads, their noses runny from the cold. Up ahead she saw where the problem lay. One of the trucks sat with its hood open, exhaling a plume of steam into the air. It was ringed by a group of soldiers who were looking at it with bewilderment, as if it were a giant carcass they'd happened upon in the road. Michael was standing on the bumper, his arms buried to the elbows in the engine. Greer, from atop his horse, said, "Can you fix it?" Michael's head emerged from under the hood.
"I think it's just a hose. I can replace it if the housing isn't cracked. We'll need more coolant, too."
"How long?"
"No more than half a hand."
Greer lifted his head and shouted to the men, "Let's tighten that perimeter. Blue up front, and mind that line of trees. Donadio! Where the hell's Donadio?" Alicia came riding from the front, her rifle slung, wreaths of steam swirling around her face. Despite the cold, she had shucked her parka and was wearing only a compartmented vest over her jersey. Greer said, "Looks like we're stuck here for a while. Might as well have a look at what's down the road. We're going to have to make up some time." Alicia heeled her horse and galloped away, riding without a glance past Hollis, who was advancing toward them from the front of the line. Greer had assigned him to one of the supply trucks, handing out food and water to the men.
"What's going on?"
he asked Sarah.
"Hang on a minute." "Major Greer," she called.
Greer was already moving down the line. He turned his horse to face her.
"It's Sancho, sir. I think he's dying."
Greer nodded.
"I see. Thank you for telling me."
"You're his CO, sir. I thought he might appreciate a visit from you."
His face showed no emotion. Nurse Fisher, we've got 4 hours of light to cover 6 hours of open ground. That's what I'm thinking about right now. Just do the best you can. Is that all?
Did he have anyone he was close to? Somebody who could be with him?
I'm sorry, I can't spare the men right now. I'm sure he'd understand. Now, if you'll excuse me. He rode away. Standing in the snow, Sarah realized she was suddenly fighting back tears.
Come on, Hollis said, and took her by the arm. I'll help you.
They made their way back to the truck. Withers had fallen asleep again. They pulled a couple of crates beside Sancho's berth. His breathing had gotten more ragged. A bit of foam had collected on his lips, which were blue with hypoxia. Sarah didn't need to check his pulse to know his heart was racing, running out the clock.
What can we do for him? Asked Hollis. Just be with him, I guess.
Sancho was going to die. She'd known that since the start, but now that it was actually happening, all her efforts seemed too meager.
I don't think it will be long now.
It wasn't. While they watched, his breathing began to slow. His eyelids fluttered. Sarah had heard it said that in the last moments, a person's life would pass before his eyes. If that was true, what was Sancho seeing? What would she be seeing if she were the one lying there? Sarah took his bandaged hand and tried to think of what to say, what words of kindness she could offer. But nothing came to her. She didn't know anything about him, only his name. When it was over, Hollis drew the blanket over the dead soldier's face. Above them, they heard Withers rousing. Sarah stood to find his eyes open and blinking, his gray face shining with sweat.
Did he?
Sarah nodded.
I'm sorry. I know he was your friend.
But he did nothing to acknowledge her. His mind was somewhere else.
God damn, he groaned. What a fucking dream. Like I was really there.
Hollis was standing beside Sarah now.
What did he say?
Sergeant, Sarah pressed. What dream? He shuddered, as if trying to loosen its hold from his memory.
Just horrible. Her voice. And that stink.
Whose voice, Sergeant?
Some fat woman, Withers answered. Some big, ugly fat woman. Breathing smoke.
At the head of the line, lifting his head from the engine of the disabled 5-ton, Michael saw Alicia, racing down the ridge, galloping through the snow. She tore past him toward the back of the line, calling for Greer.
What the hell?
Wilco was standing beside Michael, mouth open, eyes following the path of Alicia's horse. The rest of Alicia's squad was coming down the ridge now, riding toward them.
Finish this, Michael said. And when Wilco said nothing, he pressed the wrench into his hand.
Just do it, and be quick. I think we're moving out.
Michael took off after her, following the tracks she had made in the snow. With every step, the feeling grew.
Alicia had seen something. Something bad over the ridge. Hollis and Sarah climbed from the back of the truck, all of them converging on Greer and Alicia, who had both dismounted. Alicia was pointing over the ridge, her arms swinging in a broad swath, then kneeling, drawing frantically in the snow. As Michael came upon them, he heard Greer saying, "How many?"
"They must have moved through last night. The tracks are still fresh."
"Major Greer."
This was Sarah.
Greer held up a hand, cutting her off. "How many, goddammit?"
Alicia rose.
"Not many," she said. "The many. And they're headed straight for that mountain."
Chapter 64 Theo awoke not with a start, but with a feeling of tumbling. He was rolling and falling into the living world. His eyes were open. They had been open, he realized, for some time.
The baby, he thought.
He reached for Mausami and found her beside him. She shifted under his touch, drawing her knees upward. That's what it was. He'd been dreaming of the baby. He was chilled to the bone, and yet his skin was slick with sweat. He wondered if he had a fever. You had to sweat to break a fever. That's what teacher had always said, and his mother too, her fingers stroking his face as he lay in bed, burning up. But that was long ago. A memory of a memory. He hadn't had a fever in so many years he'd forgotten what it felt like. He pushed the blankets aside and rose to his feet, shivering in the cold, the moisture on his body sucking the last heat from him. He was wearing the same thin shirt he'd worn all day, stacking wood in the yard. They were ready at last for winter, everything battened down and put up and locked away. He drew off his sweat-soaked shirt and took another from a bureau. In one of the outbuildings he had found lockers full of clothes, some still in their packaging from the store. Shirts and pants and socks and thermal underwear and sweaters made of a material that felt like cotton but wasn't. The mice and moths had gotten into some of it, but not all. Whoever had stocked this place had stocked it for the long haul. He retrieved his boots and the shotgun from their place by the door and descended the stairs. The fire in the living room had burned down to glowing ash. He didn't know what time it was, but sensed it was close to dawn. Over the weeks, as he and Mouse had settled into a rhythm, sleeping the night away to awaken with the first rays of sun in the window, he had begun to apprehend the hour in a way that seemed both natural and completely new to him. It was as if he had tapped into some deep reservoir of instinct, a long-buried memory of his kind. It wasn't just the absence of the lights, as he had come to believe. It was the place itself. Mouse had sensed it too that first day, when they had walked to the river together to fish, and later in the kitchen, when she had told him they were safe. He sat to draw the boots on over his feet, took a heavy sweater from the hooks, checked the load on the shotgun, and stepped onto the porch. To the east, beyond the line of hills that hemmed the valley, a soft glow was creeping up the sky. During the first week, while Mouse slept, Theo had sat on the porch all night. With each new dawn, he'd felt a surprising pang of sadness. All his life he had feared the darkness and what it could bring. No one. Not even his father had told him how beautiful the night sky was, how it made you feel both small and large at the same time, while also a part of something vast and eternal. He stood a moment in the cold, watching the stars and letting the night air flow in and out of his lungs, bringing his mind and body to wakefulness. As long as he was up, he would set a fire, so Mausami wouldn't have to wake in a nice cold house. He moved off the porch into the yard. For days he'd done little else but haul and split wood. The woods by the river were full of deadfalls, dry and good for burning. The saw he'd found was no good, the teeth hopelessly dulled with corrosion, but the axe had done just fine. Now the fruits of his labors lay stacked in rows in the barn, with more under the eaves, draped by a plastic tarp. "Those people," he thought as he moved toward the barn door, which stood ajar. The ones in the pictures he had found. He wondered if they had been happy here. He'd found no more photographs in the house, and hadn't thought to search the car until 2 days ago. He didn't know quite what he was looking for, but after a few minutes in the driver's seat, idly pushing buttons and flipping switches and hoping something would happen, he found the right one. A little door popped open on the dashboard, revealing a wad of maps and, hidden beneath them, a leather wallet. Tucked in the folds was a card with the words Utah Tax Commission, Division of Motor Vehicles, and beneath that, a name. David Conroy. David Conroy, 1634 Mansard Place, Provo, Utah. That's who they were, he told Mausami, showing her. The Conroys. But the barn door, Theo thought. Something about the barn door. Why was it ajar like that? Could he have actually forgotten to close it? But he had closed it. He remembered this distinctly. And no sooner had he thought this than a new sound reached his ears. A quiet rustling from within. He froze, willing himself into an absolute stillness. For a long moment he heard nothing. Maybe he'd just imagined it. Then it came again. At least whatever was inside hadn't noticed him yet. If it was a viral, one shot was all he'd have. He could return to the house and warn Masami, but where would they go? His best chance was to use whatever element of surprise he still possessed. Carefully, holding his breath, he pulled the pump on the shotgun, listening for the click as the first round slid into the chamber. From deep inside the barn, he heard a soft thump, followed by an almost human-sounding sigh. He eased the barrel forward until it met the wood of the door and gently nudged it open as, behind him, a whispering voice lit up the gloom.
"Theo, what are you doing?"
Masami, in her long nightshirt, her hair spilling over her shoulders. She seemed to hover like an apparition in the pre-dawn darkness. Theo opened his mouth to speak, to tell her to get back, when the door flew open, knocking the barrel of the shotgun with a force that sent him spinning. Before he knew what had happened, the gun had fired, blasting him backward. A vaulting shadow leapt past him into the yard.
"Don't shoot!"
Masami yelled. It was a dog. The animal skidded to a halt a few meters in front of Masami, tail tucked between his legs. His fur was thick, a silvering gray with spots of black. He was facing Mouse in a kind of bow, standing on his skinny legs, his neck bent submissively, ears folded back against the woolly ruff of his shoulders. He seemed uncertain about which way to look, whether to run away or launch an attack. A low growl rose from the back of his throat. "Mouse, be careful," Theo warned.
"I don't think he's going to hurt me. Are you, boy?"
Dropping to a crouch, she held out a hand for the dog to sniff.
"You're just hungry, aren't you?
Looking in the barn for something to eat." The dog was directly between Theo and Masami. If the animal made an aggressive move, the shotgun would be useless. Theo flipped it around in his hands to use as a club and took a cautious step forward.
"Put the gun down," Masami said.
"Mouse, I mean it, Theo." She gave the dog a smile, her hand still extended.
"Let's show this nice man what a good dog you are. Come here, boy. You want to give Mama's hand a sniff?"
The animal inched toward her, backed away, then moved forward again, following the black button of his nose toward Masami's outstretched hand. As Theo watched, dumbfounded, the dog placed his face against her hand and began to lick it. Soon Mouse was on the ground, sitting in the dirt, cooing to the animal, rubbing his face and ruff. "See?" she laughed, as the dog, shaking his head with pleasure, gave a big, wet sneeze into her ear. "He's just a big old sweetie, is what he is.
What's your name, fella, Do you have a name?"
Theo realized he was still holding the shotgun over his head, ready to swing. He relaxed his posture, feeling embarrassed. Masami gave him a forgiving frown. "I'm sure he won't hold it against you."
"Are you my good boy?" she said to the animal, vigorously rubbing his mane. "What do you say, you skinny thing? How about some breakfast? How does that sound?"
The sun had lifted over the hill. The night was over, Theo realized, bringing with it a dog.
"Conroy," he said.
Masami looked at him. The dog was licking her ear, rubbing his muzzle against her in a way that seemed almost indecent.
"That's what we'll call him," Theo explained.
"Conroy." Masami took the dog's face in her hands, smushing his cheeks.
"Is that you? Are you Conroy?"
She made him nod and gave a happy laugh.
"Conroy it is."
Theo didn't want to let him in the house, but Mouse was determined. The moment the door was open, he bounded up the stairs, moving through every room like he owned the place, his long nails tapping excitedly on the floor. Mouse cooked him a breakfast of fish and potatoes, fried in lard, and set it in a bowl beneath the kitchen table. Conroy had already taken his place on the sofa,
but at the sound of crockery hitting the floor, he leapt into the kitchen and buried his face in the bowl, pushing it across the room with his long nose as he ate. Mouse filled the second bowl with water and put that down as well. When Conroy was finished with his breakfast and had taken a long, slurping drink of water, he loped from the room and returned to the sofa, where he settled back down with a windy sigh of satisfaction. Conroy the dog. Where had he come from? It was obvious he'd been around people before. Somebody had taken care of him. He was thin, but not what Theo would have called malnourished. His hair was thick with mats and burrs, but he seemed otherwise healthy. "Fill the tub," Mouse ordered him. "If he's going to sit on the sofa like that, I want to give him a bath." Outside, Theo set a fire to boil water. By the time the tub was ready, the morning sun stood high over the yard. Winter waited at their doorstep, but the middle of the day could be mild like this, warm enough for shirt sleeves. Theo sat on a log and watched while Mouse bathed the dog, rubbing handfuls of their precious soap through his silvery fur, using her fingers to smooth out the mats as best she could and picking out the burrs. The dog's face was a portrait of abject humiliation. He seemed to be saying, "A bath? Whose idea was this?" When she had finished, Theo lifted him from the tub, a great soggy thing, and Mouse eased down to her knees once more. It was getting harder each day for her to perform even these simple movements, to wrap him with a blanket. "Don't look so jealous." "Was I?" But she had him dead to rights. That was exactly how he was feeling. Conroy had thrown the blanket off to give himself a hard shake, sending drops of water arcing everywhere. "Better get used to it," Mouse said. It was true. The baby wouldn't be long now. Every part of her seemed enlarged, swollen with some benign inhabitation. Even her hair looked bigger. Theo expected her to complain about this, but she never did. Watching her with Conroy, who had finally submitted to her belated and unnecessary attempts to dry him with the blanket, he found himself suddenly and deeply glad. Glad for everything. Back in the cell, he'd wanted only to die. Before that, even. Part of him had always struggled with it. The ones who let it go. Theo knew that pull, a longing as sharp as any hunger. To hand himself over, to step into the wild darkness. It had become a kind of game he played, watching himself go about his days as if he weren't already half dead, fooling everyone, even Peter. The worse the feeling was, the easier this deception became, until, in the end, it was the deception itself that sustained him. When Michael had told him about the batteries that afternoon on the porch, part of him had thought, "Thank God it's over." And now look at him. His life had been restored. More than that, it was as if he'd been given an entirely new one. They finished the day and retired with the sun. Conroy took up residence at the foot of the bed. As they did every night, Theo and Mouse made love, feeling the baby kick between them. A persistent, attention-seeking tapping like a code. Theo had found this disquieting at first, but did no longer. It was all of a piece. The kicks and jabs of the baby in its pocket of warm flesh, and the soft cries Mausami made, and the rhythm of their movements. Even now the sounds of Conroy on the floor, watchfully shifting his bones. A blessing, Theo thought. That was the word that came to his mind as sleep eased toward him. That's what this place was. A blessing. Then he remembered the barn door. He knew he'd dropped the latch. The memory was clear and specific in his mind. Pulling the door closed on its squeaking hinges and dropping the latch into its cradle before walking back to the house. But if that was true, how could Conroy have gotten inside? In another instant he was shoving his legs into a pair of gaps, wedging on his boots with one hand and pulling on a sweater with the other. All day long, moving in and out of the house, he hadn't once done it. He'd never looked inside the barn.
"What is it?"
Malsami was saying.
"Theo, what's wrong?"
She was sitting up now, the blanket pulled over her chest. Conroy, sensing the excitement, had sprung to his feet and was prancing around the room on his long tapping nails. He grabbed the shotgun from its place by the door. "Stay here." He would have left Conroy with her, but the dog would have none of it. The moment Theo opened the front door of the house, Conroy flew into the yard. For the second time in a day, Theo crept toward the barn, the stock of the shotgun pressed to his shoulder. The door was still open, just as they'd left it. Conroy dashed ahead of him, disappearing into the darkness. He crept through the door, the shotgun raised, poised to fire. He could hear the dog moving in the dark, snuffling the ground.
"Conroy,"
he whispered.
"What is it?"
As his eyes adjusted, he saw the dog circling the ground just beyond the parked Volvo. Resting on the floor by the woodpile was a lantern Theo had left there days before. Bracing the shotgun against his leg, he quickly knelt and lit the wick. He could hear that Conroy had found something in the dirt.
It was a can.
Theo picked it up, holding it by its crinkled edges where someone had used a blade to open it. The interior walls of the can were damp, smelling of meat. Theo lifted the lantern higher, spreading its cone of light over the floor. Footprints. Human footprints in the dust. Someone had been here. Chapter 65. It was the doctor who had done it. It was the doctor who had saved her, and to whom in the end Lacey hoped she had brought some small measure of comfort. Strange what the years did to Lacey's memory of the things of that night so long ago, back at the beginning. The screams and smoke, the calls of the dying and the dead. A great black tide of endless night sweeping over the world. Sometimes it all came back to her as clearly as if it were not decades but days that had passed. At other times, the pictures she saw and the feelings she felt seemed small and doubtful and distant, like chips of straw adrift on a broad, sweeping current of time in which she floated also through all the years and years. She remembered the one, Carter. Carter, who had come to her as she had run from Walgast's car, shouting and waving. Carter, who had answered her call and swooped down toward her, alighting before her like a great, sorrowful bird.
"I am Carter."
He was not like the others. She could see, behind the monstrous vision he'd become, that he took no pleasure in his doing, that his heart was broken inside him. Chaos all around them, the screams and the gunfire and the smoke. Men were running past her.